Don't call out my insecurities on this show. That's not what this is about.
That's not what this show is about.
No. It's all about positivity, which is great because that's what Star Trek is about.
Welcome back to Get Trekked. This is Josette Detour. I just wanted to give a quick little preface. The audio in my side of the interview isn't as quality as it could be. I wasn't near a good studio with a good microphone, so for all intensive purposes, imagine me underwater, because that's what it sounds like. And, you know, I'm recording this message on my phone right now, so I'm also underwater now. Under the sea, am I right? So, that aside, please enjoy this wonderful interview we did with our friend Ethan. We had a lot of very good discussions, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. Get trekked, live long and prosper. Bye-bye.
You are with me, Godiva Lee.
And me, Josette Detour.
And me, your special guest, Ethan Siegel.
Listening to Get Trekked with KBOO Portland. Bam. All right. So, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. I met Godiva and Josie at Star Trek Las Vegas this last year. I actually met Godiva on the plane from Portland. And, like, I'm so excited because I feel like they're fans of me, but I'm fans of them.
Oh, shucks.
I talk about you, like, all the time to friends down here. I'm like, oh, my God, I know this guy. He's an astrophysicist. He's so awesome and stuff.
Well, look, not every astrophysicist has a Star Trek The Next Generation scant that they wear out to big conventions. And that is should be to the great shame of every astrophysicist out there. Without a scant, what are you really doing? What are you really doing with your life?
You're raising the bar.
I think that's part of it, is you have to be a good ambassador for all the things you want to see in the world. And if you're not willing to push the envelope, how can you expect other people to?
I just said not to slam the table, and I'm like, yeah, like, slam the table, I agree. But we are fans of you, as you had said, because you wrote a book, which we've both read. Are you, mm-hmm. You liked it, right?
I really liked it.
I hope so.
That would be such an ambush interview where, like, hey, come on our show. By the way, your book was terrible.
Well, that leads me to my next point.
All right, author of Get Trekked, and you have a new book out as well.
My book was Treknology.
Treknology. My brain
and
is...
And that book is Treknology, the Science of Star Trek from Tricorders to Warp Drive. So you had a question.
Oh, it's me. Yes. So what kind of inspired you to write Treknology?
You know, I'm dating myself. I'm older than both of our hosts here. I was a preteen teenager when Star Trek Next Generation came out and was on TV, and for me, that was my gateway into the whole Star Trek universe. That for me, I had always loved space, science, astrophysics. Like, even as a kid, the idea that we could comprehend the universe and learn the answers to these enormous questions was like, oh my God, there's something alluring, just drawing me in, pulling me into this. Star Trek was what brought me into the, you know what? It's up to us to bring this dreamlike future we have where poverty isn't an issue, where war isn't an issue, where inequality isn't an issue, and where if you work hard and are capable, you can grow up and do anything in the universe that you want to do. Star Trek was my wow moment that not only can we take what we learn and know things that we had never imagined before about the universe, but we could use this to better humanity. We could use this to build the kind of future that we all wish we had. And that, for me, was the great message of Star Trek. And so when I realized, hey, the year was, what were we coming up? We were coming up 2016, 2017, and I was like, this is going to be the 50th anniversary of the original Star Trek. This is going to be the 30th anniversary of Star Trek The Next Generation. When I was in high school, Lawrence Krauss wrote his book, The Physics of Star Trek, and I remember reading it and thinking like, oh, some of this stuff is fun to think about. And now I'm like, wow, you know, I'm an astrophysicist. Technology and science has come such a long way. Wouldn't it be fun to not just look at the physics technologies, but all of the different technologies that were featured in Star Trek, Star Trek The Next Generation, and look with what we know today at what's possible? What could we build for ourselves? What have we already made happen or even surpassed the dreams of Star Trek with? And that's where the idea for Treknology came from.
Such passion!
Wow. Can you run for office or something? I feel like we need some astrophysicists in our political system.
So I will give you the answer. This is not the first time I've been asked that. That is absolutely not something I want to do, but I love this country enough and I love this world enough that if I were called to serve, I would do it. So if you get like, hey, Ethan, we need you to like get involved in politics and help shape the positive future of the world. I wouldn't volunteer for it, but if I were volunteered for it, I would do it. I would love to have a position in any presidential administration, for example, where I got to be like a presidential science advisor. If we actually had someone who had the president's ear for like, here's how we could use science, here's how we could use technology, here's how we could invest in the future of our country to bring about a better world for all of our citizens and residents, that's the kind of job that I would absolutely jump at. But I don't want to be the president. Just because I'm old enough doesn't mean I have to do it.
Well, we'll consider that when we do the write-in ballot for you and stuff.
Uh-oh. This sounds like wheels are in motion. Community radio, you get on this.
Was that politics? Was that a subtopic that you got really into in Star Trek? Or
I always loved that. Even with all of the back behind the scenes politics that was going on in Star Trek, when you were on the Enterprise or you were on whatever starship you were on, it was the captain who was in charge. And it was the captain who was there to be that moral compass, to be like, I'm going to safeguard my crew, my morals, my principles, and everyone's safety. And also, like, the security of the Federation. Like, I'm not just going to fire on this vessel because they're threatening us and rattling their saber. I'm going to do the smart thing. And that was a brilliant thing to me, especially when I was first experiencing Star Trek as a young person, that you would have someone who was wise and experienced and not only knew when to fight, but knew when not to fight. Who knew not just when to fire, but who knew when not to fire and to get fired upon. That someone would be that careful and circumspect about all the implications that their actions would have, like, that was wonderful to me. Because I don't know how much of The Next Generation you watched, but, like, the first officer, Riker, he was always like, Captain, we have to go fire on that vessel and save our allies. And Captain's like, Mr. Worf, take us out of range. And Riker's like, no, what are you doing? And Captain's like, you'll see. And then you did see, and, like, you realize, like, only after the whole situation unfolds that there are a bunch of things going on that are larger, and there is more at stake than just, oh, someone's going to get punched in their starship by this other starship. Like, no, like, if we did this, it would be an act of aggression against this civilization that we have a tenuous peace treaty with, and we get to keep that treaty now, and we get to expose the nefarious actors because we waited. And that's something that's shown up in all sorts of works of fiction. Like, if you were fans of Avatar The Last Airbender, that was King Bumi's big thing, where he was like, no, there's neutral Jing, where you do nothing. You don't attack, you don't defend. Sometimes the best thing is you wait. If you watched Hamilton, or heard Hamilton, the musical, that's a huge thing, is wait for it. Sometimes action is not the best course. Sometimes you have to wait and see how things unfold. And for me, that was, I think, for me, Next Generation was the right Star Trek to come along at that time in my life, because Captain Picard was that voice of wisdom, was everyone's, like, dad slash captain that they wished they had, who brought that wisdom, but also that compassion, and also that willingness to, hey, when it's time to swashbuckle, I'm in there, and I'm fighting right by your side. Like, that's what you want, is someone who will stand up for all the people who can't stand up for themselves, but also is willing to put themselves out there and assume the risks for themselves to serve the greater good. What more could you ask for from, like, a moral, ethical point of view? That was, for me, the big thing about Star Trek, is it didn't just bring us these sci-fi dreams and these astrophysical, like, you know, niceties along with it. It also brought us a, but what good are you doing with this? That was why I thought Q was such a great foil, because Q was just like this character of, like, chaos and discord in there.
He basically started that,
the war with that the Borg?
Theme. Well, he started that too, but he started that theme of, like, what good are you doing? Show me. Like, wasn't that the very first episode?
The encounter at
Fox. Yeah, and then it was the whole arc of, like, the whole show, and it really, like, emphasized the themes that you're talking about. And it was such a smart way to go about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many great episodes from that series, but I think the book ends about where you first meet Q in the encounter at Farpoint, and then he shows up at the very end and gives that old, like, you know, well, you'll just have to find out, to Captain Picard in the finale, and you're like, ah, he's never going to give you the answer. And it's like life that way, that no, you're never going to get the answer, but you are going to do your best. And if you do your best, even in the most difficult situations, then not only do you have a chance to grow, but everyone around you has a chance to grow and better the world around them.
And that's what Star Trek is about.
I think at its best, that's the number one thing that all the incarnations of Star Trek are about. That you get to watch them be put in these difficult situations where there is no clear right or wrong answer. And they make a difficult choice, and then the consequences play out. And sometimes they get it right. And when they get it right, you're proud of them. And sometimes they get it wrong. And sometimes when they get it wrong, you're like, oh, you made this terrible decision and now you have to live with it. And whether that's, you know, whether that's Sisko getting it wrong and losing the trust of his dad, or whether that's Michael Burnham getting it wrong and now her captain is dead and we're in a war, like, oh no, you messed up. But that doesn't mean your journey is over. We all make mistakes, and one of the great things that I love about Star Trek is people's story continues, and they get a chance to do better the next time, and often they do. You can't see Godiva, but she is just making this gesture of, like, yay, like, that's what we all want. We all just want permission to know that oh, even no, when I, we do I bad can, things, we're not bad people.
That expression. I have another question. You're obviously, like, I've only been recording for, like, 14 minutes, and I think it's very clear that you're a very optimistic person, and I can't help but wonder, how do you stay optimistic in the current, like, news cycle of, like, doom and gloom? Like, what sort of, like, keeps this attitude going?
Well, I can't lie to you and tell you, like, oh, I always have this attitude. I'm never pessimistic. Like, because I have that. I see things going on in the world, in my community, in our country, and I think, like, oh, this is us just moving 180 degrees in the wrong direction. Like, we could not be messing this up more if we tried. And when I think like that, I think, okay, well, that's how you feel, because you see something is wrong and you recognize that something is wrong. Well, what can you do about it? And the answer is often, well, there's nothing I can do about it. But often, if I think hard enough, I'm like, you know, I can put something good out into the world. it doesn't matter how big or how small it is. What matters to me is that thought of, what good can I do in this situation? You know, we had, for example, last week, we had, you know, whenever this airs. So end of January, beginning of February, we had a huge, huge cold snap hit the entire United States west of the, east of the Rockies. Edit that, please.
Don't worry.
No, just leave it in. Ethan doesn't know west from east. He thinks he's an astrophysicist. It's fine, the North Pole.
Your credibility is suddenly just gone.
The fact that you even came on the show means your credibility is slowly going downhill.
That's okay. That's okay.
If you're on the show, that means it's over. I'm sorry.
All right. I'll take it. It doesn't matter. Street cred goes up, science cred goes down. It's all good. it's a trade-off. No, but that's what I think of. Is like, okay, like, we have this cold snap, and lo and behold, what happens is we've got the President of the United States taking to Twitter and telling everyone, what happened to global warming?
I saw that.
Think, like, well, what can I do? And I'm like, you know what? I can educate people. I can go out there and I can explain how, you know what, we do have global warming. And one of the consequences of global warming is in these northern latitudes, like near the Arctic Circle, in northern Canada, up in Russia, up in the very northern part of the world, we have less sea ice. We have less ice covering the land down there. Ice is very reflective. Ocean or landmass is less reflective. So at these high latitudes that used to be covered in ice, which means they would reflect the sunlight away, they wouldn't absorb it, now they're absorbing that sunlight. There's more heat at these high mid-latitudes, 50 degrees north, 55, 60 degrees north. And so if they're absorbing more heat and heat rises up into the stratosphere, the upper layers of the atmosphere, then that has a chance to migrate north into the pole. If you get a stratospheric warming event, what can that do? That can displace the cold air at the pole and move it down into the United States. If you've heard of the polar vortex, normally it stays up at the pole and it's nice and happy there, especially in the winter. But if it gets hot around it, that warm air is going to migrate in and push that polar vortex away from the pole. It's going to destabilize the polar vortex. That's what caused the cold snap. That's what caused all those people to freeze to death in Iowa. That's what caused all that snow, all those shutdowns, all that damage to our infrastructure. So when you say, you hear that like thing that you know is messed up, like, where's global warming? And the answer is actually, it's all over the globe. And here's the science behind it, and here's the opportunity to educate people. Now, I know that not everyone's going to listen because a lot of people didn't logic themselves into their position on certain issues. And so if you don't logic yourself into that position, it's really hard to logic yourself out of it. But that's the big weapon that we have. You know, we have not only personal truths and scientific truths and historical truths in our life, but we have ways of figuring out what is actually true in this universe. We can tell what's true from what's not true. That's, for me, that's what I love about science, is that you can take your ideas and your hypotheses and you can confront them with data and measurements and experiments and observations, and you can say, like, hey, are my ideas, are my theories, are they panning out? And if they are, what comes next? What can we do about it in a responsible way? In a way that's not only responsible to the scientific truths of the universe, but in a way that's responsible to society and humanity. And so that's how I try to stay optimistic, is I try and think, even if it's a small thing, what's a positive thing I can do? And sometimes it makes me feel better, and sometimes it doesn't make me feel better. And sometimes I think to myself, Ethan, you are just writing about science on the internet. You are just going to take a rash of doo-doo for all of your efforts, and no one's going to appreciate them. And then I have to tell myself, that's not true, Ethan. You've got to realize that most of the people who do appreciate it, I'm making the zip my lips. Most of the people who do appreciate it aren't going to express it. They're just going to be like, yeah, that's what I think too. the people who are going to come after you, who are going to be like, hey, I'm going to let you know I'm your enemy and you're going to encounter me. Look, that's the first rule of any video game. If you keep encountering enemies, that means you're moving in the right direction. So I try and take the negativity that I see in the world, that I run into in my own life, and remember that there's a positive reason for it. It's because I'm fighting for something, I'm believing in something, I'm pushing for something that I think is important to be out there. I'm pushing for a world that's scientifically literate, where all people are treated as inherently of equal value to one another, and where people can treat each other with respect and not have to worry about their own safety or security as they move through the world.
And I think that really kind of ties into what has made Star Trek so long lasting. And it's always in the little details. It's always in these loud voices that they fight against with small acts of compassion and small acts of education and things like that, especially in the Next Generation, I find. And I think you're 100% on track with that.
It always, it's like, it's a whole episode of a battle of trying to better a situation that, I did it. Don't tap the table. What's the episode where Data gets stuck down on that planet and he's trying to convince them to evacuate and they don't want to evacuate, and it's like this whole freaking ordeal, and he's like, I am trying to tell you these are the facts, that you are going to like get seriously hurt or killed if you don't leave. I don't believe that. I don't know. You're just trying to, you know, like pull one over us, and like it's like,
that's right.
There's a lot of themed episodes in that direction of like 30 minutes, 45 minutes of, I am trying to help you. Please let me help you. What do I need to do to help you?
And sometimes the ways around it are about understanding where they're coming from. Like, yeah, you're not reasoning the way we're used to you reasoning. You're not communicating the way we're used to other people communicating. But that doesn't mean that this is a hopeless situation, right? When you meet a culture that speaks entirely in metaphor, and you don't understand the literal meaning of their words because the literal meaning doesn't make any sense. You know, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, right? Shaka when the walls fell, right? What are they talking about? It's only when you realize how they're communicating and what they're trying to say with the words that they're using that you can communicate with them. For that episode that you're talking about, I think that was the same one where it was Worf who was like, oh, we have to go on, and he learns about the journeys that they take, where they take a journey to a new planet and they rig up this whole like remote holodeck thing where they beam them aboard and they have them travel through all these landscapes, and the holodeck starts glitching, and you can see the barriers, and they're like, oh no, what's that? And they're like, those are lightning storms. That's a sign of LaForge. It means our journey is blessed. And they're like, okay, great, brilliant. Like, what a way to bring your technology and your, you know, conceits of the limitations of your technology into their world in a way where they can relate to it and be on the same page. What I loved about it also is, in a lot of different ways, you know, one of the technologies I feature in my book is about androids, is about the fact that we would like to build artificial humans that are intelligent, that sound like humans, that are indistinguishable from humans, and that also just seem to they seem indistinguishable from us. And you look at something like Data, and Data is as close to that as really our dreams will take us. Like, that's just, wow, like what a good human-like robot. And yet he's distinctly not human. And that is what makes him such an interesting character to me. I love that episode in Next Generation called The Measure of a Man, where they put him on trial to see, is he his own autonomous being with a right to what happens to him? Or can other people determine, actually, he's property, he's just a machine, and we can disassemble him, and we can, you know, take him apart, and we can try and make more of him? And that was a really, really interesting question, because it gets right to the core of an issue of, what makes a person? And Riker gives a crushing prosecution where he turns him off and bam, QED, he's clearly not a person. You could turn him off, you could turn him on, you can program him, you can disassemble him. Like, he's very clearly not a person.
I'm getting all sorts of defensive over here.
That's okay. I'll spoil it for you.
Your Honor, I think you'll find.
30 years out of date, but spoiler, Captain Picard defends Data and wins.
If you haven't watched it since it's aired in the past 30 years, then I'm sorry, we're going to have to spoil it for you.
Like, it's like, just turn off the podcast, go watch it, come back. Do you know what? I always think of like that one line from that when Picard is giving his speech, like, you want to seek out new life, well, there it sits. Like, that gives me chills every single time. It's just such a gut, like, punch in the gut, you know?
Yeah, and that's just such a good one, because he lays out, like, there are three criteria that everyone agrees on are required for something to be considered its own life form, and or its own intelligent life form. And he gives the first one, and Data clearly means that. And he gives the second one, and Data clearly means that. And he gives the third one, and the third one is basically asking, like, does Data have a soul? Like, that's not the words they use, but that's basically asking, like, does he have a soul? And Captain Picard looks around, and he looks at everyone who's judging, and he's like, I don't know. Do you know? And clearly no one knows. What do you do in that situation? And I love that moral lesson that in the face of ambiguity, what side do you err on? And the answer has to be, you have to err on the side of compassion, on the side of humanity, on the side of life. You have to err on the side of, here is something new and rare and precious, and it deserves a right. It deserves the right to exist. You can't just snuff it out because it's foreign to you. And that is also just such a part of the essence of Star Trek that I feel should always have a place in our society. That is a message that I think never goes out of style, is when you see something, someone different from you that you don't understand, you don't have to understand it. You just have to recognize that it has a right to exist.
Hmm. Well said. Any questions you have, Godiva?
Yeah. I wanted to get on to the topic of your books, because you have a new one coming out, right?
I do have a new book coming out. My tentative title for this book, this is not about Star Trek, it is about science. This book is called Before, and it's about the scientific story of where the entire universe came from. I love this story because if you ask most people, they'll be like, oh, right, that's the Big Bang, right? I've heard of that. That hasn't been the scientific answer for almost 40 years. For almost 40 years, scientists have said the Big Bang couldn't possibly have been the beginning of the universe. There needed to be something that came before it and set it up. And this theory is called cosmic inflation. It has given a number of predictions, and surprisingly to most people, many of those predictions have actually, we've done experiments to go and make the measurements and find out, did we have a Big Bang without inflation, or did we have inflation? And guess what? We had inflation. They all give back the same answer. This is an amazing, remarkable story, and I've written the book, and I've illustrated the book by hand, so if you want to see some... Well, I guess if I drew them and they're in a book, then I'm a professional now. But if you want to see some ultra amateur artwork in a professional book, you can do this. What's really amusing to me is I'm down to my two finalists for publishers. The two finalist publishers are Harvard University Press and MIT Press. Ooh. And I think this is hilarious that schools that I did not get into as an undergrad, that I did not get into for grad school, that I did not get a postdoc at or a professorship at, now they both want to publish my book. And I think that's amazing. It's like, hey, everybody, you can make it after all. You can shatter that glass ceiling. Just write a book.
Did you get the two offers and you just lean back and you're like, that's right.
Oh, I don't take anything for granted. You know, I think that they're both great presses and they both offer great opportunities. And I'm sure whichever one I go with, that I will be extraordinarily happy with. But that said, like, there's a little bit about me that's like, hee-hee, I can't believe this is happening. I still, I'm 40 years old. I have all this legit cred behind me, and I still feel like an imposter. So if you still feel like an imposter in what you do, like, oh, no, I'm just, like, I still feel like I'm a teenager figuring it out, pretending to be a grown-up, that feeling doesn't need to ever go away, and that's okay. We all have that insecurity, and you just need to know that no one knows what they're doing, but we're all doing our best, and that's worth something, that your best is worth something.
Aww.
I have a question about technology. If you could pick one of the more implausible technology to have in real life, what would you pick?
Oh, man. I mean, I think the two that I would always go for that are on the implausible scale, but wow, wouldn't it be great if we had them? The two that I always find myself choosing between are transporter,
yes,
and warp drive. Because without warp drive, man, making an actual trek to the stars is going to be real time consuming and real resource intensive and real difficult. But if there's a shortcut, if there's a way that we could beat the speed of light or contract space in front of us and get somewhere fast, then we'll have a chance to not only explore what's out there in our lifetime, but to come back and share what we learn with everyone here on Earth without having to wait, you know, oh, there's that awesome star 40 light years away. It's called TRAPPIST-1. It's got 7 Earth-sized planets around it. What's going on those planets? Well, if I don't have warp drive, then even if I go there at almost the speed of light, it's going to take me more than 40 years to get there. And even if I send the signals back with, here's what we found, it's going to take them 40 years to get back. I'm not going to look so good in 80 years. Even young people like you aren't going to look so good in 80 years. Like, I don't want to wait that long.
I'm going to look good. I don't know about you, but I'm going to look good.
All right.
I'm going to look great.
I'm not going to look good. It's arguable. I might already be in the whoo, the long, slow decline down the hill with the one door at the end. No. This isn't that kind of podcast. Optimism.
With that beard, you're going to make it far, kid.
That's right. No one's going to stop the
most epic beard in the galaxy.
Ooh, can you even see the double mustache on your screen?
I can't. Oh, there it is. Even better. Oh, my God.
Yeah, those are the two technologies that I wanted to ask you about, too, was the transporter and the warp drive, because so far they're saying that our bodies can't even handle going faster than not even the speed of light, right? Because we would get crushed. They can't, like, think of a way to get us faster than the speed of light.
Well, a human body doesn't have a problem with high speeds.
Yeah.
We only have a problem with high accelerations. So part of the thing is, if you want warp drive, you need some kind of negative mass or negative energy. That's what's required if you want to actually compress the space in front of you. So this is a fun thing. If you had asked me 25 years ago, oh, like, can we have warp drive? Is that, like, a possible thing? I would have been like, no one's ever figured out a solution to Einstein's equations, to general relativity, where you can have faster-than-light travel. But in 1994, all that changed when theoretical physicist Miguel Alcubierre came up with a solution to Einstein's equation that said, actually, you can totally go faster than the speed of light. Alcubierre, by the way, was a grad student who was procrastinating doing his PhD thesis and said, I love Star Trek. I'm going to try and find a space-time solution that makes warp drive possible. And he did. And it's, for my money, it's the most impressive thing he's done in his whole career. I think that's super awesome. So he did. He said, actually, you can. If you can compress the space in front of you and drive your starship through it, then you can effectively move way faster than the speed of light. The only cost is the opposite of compression, rarefaction or expansion, is what you need to do to the space behind you. So you compress the space in front of you, you expand the space behind you, you go through the compressed space, and bam, you've traveled 40 light years in maybe just 6 months. And how awesome is that? And the answer is that's very awesome. So what do you need to do to make this happen? The answer is you need some type of negative mass or negative energy. So far, we don't have this in our universe as far as we know. But I'm optimistic that maybe we do have this in our universe, because one of the things we've never measured is we know we have matter, and we know which direction matter falls in the gravitational field. It goes down. We also know we have antimatter. This is the anti-counterpart. You take matter and antimatter, they annihilate, boom, pure energy equals mc squared. What direction does antimatter fall in a gravitational field? We don't know. We've never measured it well enough. We've made neutral anti-atoms. We've made anti-hydrogen, and we've actually confined it in a trap for like 20 minutes. This is actually in my book, which is awesome. There is an experiment going on at CERN right now. I believe it's called the TRIUMF, T-R-I-U-M-F experiment. Or maybe it's the Alpha G experiment. It was built by TRIUMF in Canada. Anyway, what they're going to do is they're going to take neutral antimatter and they're going to drop it and see which way it falls. If it falls down, bah, then we don't have negative mass. But if it falls up at 9.8 meters per second squared, just like normal matter falls down at the surface of Earth, then all of what I've told you about warp drive is now possible. And to answer your question about, won't we get crushed? Oh, we'll need inertial dampeners. Oh, those don't exist either. The reason those don't exist is because we don't have any way to shield something from gravitational or inertial acceleration. But if we had negative mass, just like in electricity, you have positive charges and negative charges, you have things like conductors, where you have materials where positive and negative charges can move around and rearrange themselves and shield you from outside electric fields. Well, if you had negative mass, you could move those negative masses around and shield yourself from this acceleration. So human bodies all of a sudden could accelerate as fast as you wanted, and as long as you had this negative mass distributed in a way to cancel it out, you wouldn't be crushed. So that's my big dream for man. If only physics were slightly different, then we could have warp drive and inertial dampeners. And here's how physics would have to be different. And hey, actually, we've never measured it. Maybe it is actually different. Let's do the experiment to find out. So do I think it's likely? Nah, I think probably antimatter is going to fall down. If you pinned me up against a wall and held a knife to my throat and said, which way is the antimatter going to fall? I would say, down. I think it's down. Please don't kill me. I think it's down. But if it's up, oh man, that's my big hope. That's my big hope. Because there are only, in my book, Technology, there were 28 technologies that are profiled. Only four of them are thought to be a physical impossibility. But all of them could become possible if there's just slightly different, something slightly different about the laws of physics. And those are the four: inertial dampeners, transporters, subspace communication, because there's no such thing as subspace, only the regular kind, but you never know. And also inertial dampeners. That's it. Those are the four technologies that we think are impossible. Everything else is either on its way or already there. Everything else that was envisioned as a technology in Star Trek or Star Trek The Next Generation, we've done an amazing job of actually building the future that was originally a science fiction dream. And that's an incredible testament to me of not only the spirit of human ingenuity and innovation, but also the enduring legacy of Star Trek and the impact it's had on our world. Imagine in the original series what they would make of a smartphone like we have today. Even your super old one from like 4 years ago that you pull out, and like you show that to like Captain Kirk, they're like, hey, Captain Kirk, you want to get rid of like half your technology and just use this instead? Because you can. You think your wireless like flip communicator is advanced? Look at this smartphone. You think the next generation ship's computer is advanced? Hey, have you heard of the internet? We could just look something up. You don't need this huge, enormous database over here. Hey, do you want to, you like your pads, your personal, you know, personal display device that you're like, oh, we've got such good one. We've got such good one here. Boop, 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 boop. Actually, it's fake. It's just like a light up thing that's laminated.
One of the scenes from Star Trek that I laugh at the most is in Deep Space Nine. And I think Bashir is talking to Sisko and he's trying to like give him all this evidence of it was what are they called?
Jem'Hadar?
No, genetically advanced. Jem'Hadar? Genetically advanced? Oh. Is that what they're called? Genetically... I'll do like a rough cut over what I said. Like
you'll,
I'll look
it
up on
it in.
Google
you'll
later.
Splice
like
it in.
Genetically engineered.
Yeah. We all know what you're talking about.
And they're trying to prove what the next move of the Dominion is going to be. And so he's like, "Well, I've got all this proof." And Sisko's like, "Oh, well, let me see your proof." And he hands him one iPad. He's like, "Well, I've got that." And then he hands him another iPad. He's like, "And I've got that evidence. And I've got this evidence." And he's got like three iPads that he's juggling. He's like, "If you need more evidence, I have like five more iPads over here." And I'm just like, oh my god.
No, that's like
just send it to the cloud.
It's just so much information that it requires several iPads to hold all the information.
No, that's a real Zoolander moment for Bashir, where it's like the files are in the computer and like throws the computer off.
Bashir's a genius, but oh my god, sometimes he is dumb.
Yeah, agreed.
Oh yeah, I could go off on.
We all agree.
Yep. If random little question, if do you think one that you would be on a flagship of the Federation, and two, what position do you think you would hold?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. I mean, you're right. Everyone wants to be captain. Everyone wants to be the one calling the shots.
I'd be happy just to be the janitor on the flagship. Honestly, like
You know, for me, I think I'd be very happy if I got to be on a science ship, if I got to be on a science vessel, as long as the project I was working on was something that I was passionate about and interested in. If I got to do something where I felt like this thing I'm investigating is going to help shed light on some great mystery or help cure some disease or fix some people or liberate some people. If I got to feel invested that what I was doing was going to be a force for good in the galaxy, I think I would be happy even to be a small part of a team. But it would have to be something for me where I at least got to do something abstract. I think if they stuck me in engineering, I would feel stuck. I'd be like, oh, I don't care that you've got a coolant leak. I don't just get a plumber to fix it. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, just that would be my only thing. Like, you want to put me as a science officer. You want to put me on the bridge. You want to put me in navigation. This is all good stuff. I mean, who doesn't dream about like flying a starship? Like, that would be good times for me. But, but yeah, don't put me in engineering. That's all. I just don't give me Scotty's red shirt in the original series. Don't give me the yellow uniform in Next Generation. But, you know, in shows like Discovery, I think like everyone gets like kind of the same uniform. So I can be on board with that. Just like, yeah, you could put me on that. I probably wouldn't do so good on the Black Ops ships. I probably wouldn't do so good in Section 31. That's probably not my style. The stuff I do, it should be above board. I'm a play by the rules kind of person.
I would not be good in any private investigation sector of the Federation. I'm just really bad at lying. I can't be sneaky for shit.
No, you keep banging the table. You're not going to be the stealthy ninja that they need to
carry
that out.
They're listening right now and they're like, she's out. Nope. Don't want her.
Yeah. The Klingons are watching you and they're like, we're not going to have Volk be implanted into you. You are not going to be a good Ash Tyler. This is the wrong person for the job.
I feel like I wouldn't be so much on the crew of Starfleet so much as I would be Guinan, because that's just like tell me your troubles, friend, and like not, because I'm definitely not like a science type person, but I like love it just hearing about it. I don't know. Plus, like serving people drinks.
So you would be like the ship's counselor, but with alcohol.
You know? Yeah.
That's great. I mean, Synthahol, which is a great technology. Oh. Like, that's one that I'm actually excited is on the way because, man, who wouldn't love all the positive effects of alcohol? The, like, feeling good about yourself and having the increased self-confidence and the euphoria, but also without the drunkenness and the slurred speech and the hangover and the dead brain cells.
And then they have a shot for a hangover too, don't they?
They have, in Roddenberry's original vision, they were like, oh, it's just your adrenaline. And no, Gene, that's not how biology works, but good idea. But they have a technology now where they, we know in your body, all those feelings you get from alcohol come from the products of alcohol in your body binding to certain receptors. And we have a way to design whole classes of drugs that actually we're just going to bind to a subset of these receptors. We call them partial GABA agonists. And there are like 6 different subunits, and we are making pharmacologically ones that only bind to some of them. But then if you need to be sober, there's a pill you can take that will kick those breakdown products of alcohol out of those receptors, and you're sober again. And this works within like 15 to 20 minutes, which would be incredible that you could be out drinking, dancing, having a good time at your, you know, episode 7 of season 1 Star Trek Discovery disco dance party, which, by the way, reminds me of every like scientist convention ever where, oh, we're all so dorky and we're such bad dancers and we don't care and everyone is having a great time.
Wait. There are scientist conventions where you do disco parties?
So we're not going to edit that out, but I am not going to elaborate. But I will say that scientists are people too. Josie, scientists are people too.
Yeah, Josie, scientists are people too.
Don't get out of my face, Godiva.
Sunglasses. No, I forgot my regular glasses at work, so I am wearing my prescription sunglasses.
Never mind.
If you would wait 2 seconds, okay, God.
Jeez, Jordy, just get the LASIK.
So, let's see. What note do we want to end this on?
B flat. No.
Did you say B fly?
I said B flat because she said, ah.
Oh.
And you can all go to hell, as Ryan would say.
Hey. Ethan, do you want to do a plug, just a short description of your book and what websites they can find you on?
Sure. I'm Ethan Siegel. You can find me at Starts With A Bang on Twitter, on Facebook, and on Tumblr at Starts With A Bang. My book is Treknology, The Science of Star Trek from Tricorders to Warp Drives, available wherever books are sold, including Powell's, Barnes & Noble's, and Amazon. And look for me and my blog, Starts With A Bang, on Forbes. 6 new articles every week. You won't want to miss it.
And you're going to be at Rose City Comic Con, right?
I was at Rose City Comic Con this last year. I hope to be back again this year.
Wizard World? It's a thing.
We'll see.
Cool. All right. Groovy. Well, thank you so much. Josie, have a good one.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on your show.
Get tricked.
Get tricked.
Get tricked.